This hour of the Jason Rancho brought to you by You Build It. Lots of news is happening all around the world and right here at home. So let's find out what's trending.
What's trending? Crime.
Homelessness in Ballard has simply engulfed that neighborhood. It's being ignored by the council, by the mayor, and as a result, the homeless folks are turning to crime. And so it's no longer just a homelessness issue. It is a criminal homelessness issue. And so a bunch of businesses near a park in Ballard, they decided to set up what essentially is a network of surveillance cameras to catch the utter lawlessness in the area with hopes that it's going to gain some attention. That the city will see what's going on and it'll make it impossible for them to ignore. And boy, did the surveillance cameras capture a whole lot of crime. We're talking about drug deals and prostitution, assaults and stolen bikes. Jacob Parker works nearby. And he told Como TV, this area is getting so incredibly dangerous.
It started to become more and more criminal over time because they weren't really regulating who they were allowing there. A couple times I've seen a guy come out with a scythe and just start swinging around.
Oh my gosh. That, of course, is insane. And he says that more and more and more often there are confrontations between the criminal homeless and the folks who live and work in the area. And unfortunately, none of it is getting any better. In fact, anytime there's some kind of issue in the area, they go ahead and they look at their surveillance footage, and it just, as it so happens, captures homeless people going back into the same encampment.
We check the footage, and it starts from the camp, goes to the crime, goes back to the camp. The damage, the unsightliness, health hazard, it's getting worse as time progresses.
Now, this next part is not shocking at all. Not even a little bit. You see, these business owners complained to the city. They complained to Councilmember Dan Strauss. What do you think the response was? Nothing. They said nothing. Dan Strauss doesn't respond to concerns about homelessness. We've talked to business owners on this show in the exact same position, struggling to get by during a pandemic only to have a homelessness crisis making matters worse, complaining to Dan Strauss, asking for some kind of help, and he ignores it. They do not care about the business community if they can't simply respond to an email over a legitimate concern. That's the message that they're sending. They do not care about the business community. Of course, we're not shocked by that. We're not shocked by that. This is the same council that continuously pushes tax upon tax, regulation upon regulation, that makes it untenable to do business here. And that's with big business. But they don't realize that they're also hurting small businesses. You know what they'll say after they pass this payroll tax, for example? This is only going to impact the biggest businesses here. Everyone else is going to be fine. Well, maybe they don't get hit with the same tax, but they're not fine because they're dealing with the criminal homelessness crisis. And this council and this mayor does nothing. They simply do nothing. How is that leadership? And how is it that people in these neighborhoods keep putting into positions of power the same types of politicians? Are we all masochists in Seattle? Perhaps. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? National.
This Hunter Biden issue is not going away. And that's not for lack of trying for CNN trying to push this away. Trying to make this not into an issue. I guess pretending that when the campaign literally won't say the texts and emails are false, they're going to pretend that that's not informative. And what we've heard, as Joe Biden has put a lid on his campaign until Thursday, putting a lid on a campaign means you don't plan on doing any public events. He announced that lid yesterday until Thursday. Now, part of it, I understand that someone of his age and mental fitness, you need a lot of time off to be prepared for a debate. But you think maybe it also had to do with people starting to ask some questions he doesn't want to answer? Because he did not do well with the court packing question. Do you think he's going to do well under pressure of, what exactly did you do with Hunter Biden and helping him get a job? Are the emails correct? Are these real emails? Because Fox News has confirmed, at least in part, the emails that the New York Post had originally put up. They contacted someone who was on the actual email chain. It is remarkable how some folks in the media, mostly CNN and the New York Times and MSNBC and the Seattle Times, who I don't even think has written about this, are giving it a pass. And sometimes they're giving it a pass by allowing folks like Senator Chris Murphy to claim that this is all a Russian propaganda strategy.
So the very fact that these emails come into the public sphere from Rudy Giuliani, the fact that Andrei Derkach seems to know more about these emails than almost anybody else, tells you where they're coming from. I mean, at some point, you sort of have to believe what you see, which is that when individuals who are either identified Russian agents or are conspiring with Russian agents are providing the information upon which mainstream media are reporting, you have to understand what the deal is here. And
except, by the way, when it comes to the Steele dossier, in that case, you never have to consider where that bogus dossier came from. And yet it was put on TV every single day for months on end. Other than that, it's really important to look at the source.
Again, I'm not alone here. 50 high-level intelligence agents, people who have worked in the intelligence agencies, came out and said that this is most likely Russian propaganda.
It's most likely from propaganda. All you have to do is ask these agents who no longer work for the U.S. government. But you should be asking the intelligence agents. How about this? Let's ask the director of national intelligence. That kind of counts as an intelligence agent. He's at the top. He runs DNI. John Ratcliffe.
This is exactly what I said I would stop when I became the director of national intelligence, and that's people using the intelligence community to leverage some political narrative. And in this case, apparently Chairman Schiff wants anything against his preferred political candidate to be deemed as not real and is using the intelligence community, or attempting to use the intelligence community, to say there's nothing to see here. Don't drag the intelligence community into this. Hunter Biden's laptop is not part of some Russian disinformation campaign, and I think it's clear that the American people know that.
I hope so. I hope that the American people know that. But it's not a message that you're getting from CNN or MSNBC or the New York Times. How weird is that? Will it come up on Thursday at the debate? It should, but will it? Let's talk about that when we come back. How ironic is this? When did this tweet come in? A minute ago.
Yeah, under 30 seconds or 38 seconds.
5:12 p.m. So a little bit over a minute. Breaking. The Department of Justice and the Federal Bureau of Investigation have both reportedly confirmed that a laptop allegedly belonging to Joe Biden's son is not part of a Russian disinformation campaign. Actually, my friend Sean Langeal, a Fox News producer from Fox News at Night, which I'm going to be on later tonight, just tweeted, a senior federal law enforcement official tells Fox News, FBI and DOJ concur with Ratcliffe that Hunter Biden's laptop and the emails in question weren't part of a Russian disinformation campaign. Number two, the FBI does have possession of the Hunter Biden laptop in question. Ooh. We knew that, though. How curious. But no, it's a Russian in like disinformation campaign. It's Russia.
Why wasn't that story released like 15 minutes ago before we just did a whole segment?
If I had a better producer, maybe you would have.
I'm sorry. Do you want me to produce that story?
Yeah, I want you to do it.
Yeah, let me call up the DOJ.
Here's what
real quick.
I want you to do. Push that button.
What's trending on the campaign trail?
So, debate is happening on Thursday night. We'll, of course, be carrying it live, commercial-free, on KTTH starting at 6 p.m. If you don't have the KTTH app, you should download it, because not only does that mean you can listen to the debate wherever it is that you happen to be at 6 p.m. on Thursday night, but you'll also get a friendly reminder, a little alert that shows up on that phone telling you when it's happening, so you will not miss a moment of it. Text the keyword app to 1-800-465-8770. Text APP to 1-800-465-8770, and I'll send you a link so you can download this app. Now, there are going to be some changes to the debate format. The most notable being that the president and former vice president will have their mics muted during portions of the final debate on Thursday. Remember, this is the final debate. We're not getting three. We're only getting two. And mics will be muted during portions of it. Now, the Trump campaign is upset with this. I don't think they should be, but they are. The president talked about it on Fox and Friends this morning.
Well, I think the whole thing is crazy. This commission, I had problems with them 4 years ago where they stifled out my mic during my conversation with Crooked Hillary. And, you know, they muted my mic. They did a whole thing. They did this to me already. They modulated it at the time. And they actually had to write me a letter of apology. And they did it on purpose. Look, these people are not good people, this commission. A lot of funny things go on with them.
For Ronna McDaniel, the chair of the RNC, the national RNC, she says the Commission on Presidential Debates essentially is promoting election interference.
This is a city that's, plugged in for Joe Biden, and to have this supposed nonpartisan commission continue to make rule changes without consulting the Trump campaign, break promises that they made to the Trump campaign, to unilaterally make decisions that ended the second debate, it's just really shameful, and they're hurting the American people, and it is a form of election interference.
It is a form of election interference. If they didn't actually agree to these rules or propose these rules before enacting them, they're interfering. Now, that said, I think this is a positive case of interference. The president bailed Joe Biden out moment after moment after moment when he interrupted. There were so many times where Joe Biden was fumbling, where he was struggling to come up with a coherent thought, only to be saved by President Trump, who decided to engage, talk over him. It was not a good strategy. It was not a good strategy. Started off fine. First 15 minutes or so, it was like, oh, you know what? I kind of like this. He's aggressive, but not too aggressive. Then, bam, Trump gets uber aggressive. Too aggressive. Joe Biden does his worst when he is asked a tough question and doesn't have a response. Now, an occasional interruption actually would benefit President Trump. But based on that first debate, he's not able, or he wasn't able, to just sort of moderate his interruptions. Now, I imagine, because remember, there's not going to be a crowd there, and they're not that far apart, 12 feet apart. President Trump might still interrupt, talking a little bit loudly and asking him to answer a question or something. But I think ultimately this is going to serve him well. Now, the other thing that I think ultimately will serve him well, apparently, the topic for this debate was supposed to be on national security. But the moderator, Kristen Welker, she's got a lot of topics, none of them having to do with national security. They're going to focus on COVID-19, race, climate change, national security in a leadership role, and American families. National security and leadership is listed last. It's not going to be about national security. You'll get a couple questions in there, maybe. I think, again, the president is better served here. I know that the way questions are framed on coronavirus can play to a weakness of the president. That is true. But on the topic of race, the president has created an employment system in this country, an economy in this country, that benefited African Americans in historic numbers. Same for Latinos. While others have talked about criminal justice reform, hey, guess what? President Trump, this administration actually passed some. Bring up the fact that over the course of the last week, got 50 Cent endorsing President Trump after he found out about Joe Biden's tax plan. Bring these things up. The president, according to their internals, was clearly doing well. Better than they expected with young black male voters. Play to that. Mention Ice Cube is now part of your efforts to address some of these issues and not having to wait until after the election. Granted, Ice Cube is an anti-Semite, and so I don't really like him. However, if you can utilize this to a brief advantage, go for it. I don't like that they don't think that these topics actually benefit them, because I do think it benefits the Trump campaign if he handles it well. But of course, we're going to find out all about that on Thursday. And maybe it doesn't even matter. Because at 5:30, we're going to talk with Helmut Norpoff. He is a professor. He is someone who's got modeling that looks at the polls, looks at certain situations on the ground, inserts the data, and is able to figure out who he predicts will win. He thinks it's going to be a landslide that President Trump wins re-election. Now, of course, that is against what the other polls say. This is not a poll, of course. However, he is one of the outliers. And we're going to ask him about this position because perhaps it doesn't matter what happens during the debate. The writing is on the wall. President Trump is going to be the clear winner. I've taken the Jason Rantz model, both named after my modeling career and also my political models.
The modeling career didn't go so well because you're in radio. If the modeling career went, like, decent, you might end up in TV. Right now, you are in radio.
I'm on TV tonight.
Yeah, but, like, occasionally, you know.
And I'm on twice a week.
A broken clock is right twice a day.
Well, a week, at least. Here's my model, and it served me well because I only did it the last time, and I was right. If the president is within 4 to 5 points statewide, he will win that state. If he's down up to 5 points, because the pollsters don't understand how to reach Trump supporters, and it doesn't take into account the many people who feel like they would be judged by these pollsters by saying they're Trump supporters, if he's down by five, he is going to win. If it's 6 or 7, it's possible, but unlikely. If it's more than 7 or 10, he's going to lose. But if it's within 5 points, I think he wins. That's my model. But let's ask the professor when we come back. Welcome back to the Jason Rantz Show live on this Tuesday afternoon. How much trust should we put in the polling? President Trump is down according to the Real Clear Average poll. But of course, he won back in 2016 with polls saying pretty much the same exact thing. Helmut Norpoff is a professor in Stony Brook's Department of Political Science. He's got a model out that is pretty unique. And it's correctly predicted 25 of the last 27 elections. He has been pretty bullish on the president's reelection campaign. So where does he stand right now? Helmut Norpoff joins us live. Helmut, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So before we get into the actual prediction, take us through just briefly what's different with your model than some of the others.
about the others. I mean, I know about my model, and as the name says, it's about the influence of presidential primaries, about the outcome in November. And the pattern is that whichever candidate does better in the primaries ends up the winner in November, and it really only depends on the early primaries. I used to put a lot of stock in New Hampshire. I've added a little bit to that, but really primaries tell you a lot about what is happening, and so this time Donald Trump did very well in New Hampshire. He didn't have a test in South Carolina where the party canceled it, but Joe Biden, by comparison, did very poorly in New Hampshire and did well in South Carolina, but the combination still leaves him sort of way short of what Donald Trump did in the other primaries. And that's a very, very solid, reliable predictor all the way going back to 1912 when primaries started. And as you said, 25 of the 27 elections, the model gets it right. Of course, I wasn't around to make a forecast in 1912 or any election until about 96 when I started that. But at least the model algorithm fits pretty well in these early elections as well.
So essentially, you're looking at how the candidates do in a primary to look big picture at how they're going to perform in the general. But in this case, you had Donald Trump, while he was a part of the primary, he wasn't running against anyone. Does that matter?
I have a hard time hearing you. You're very, very, very quiet. The sound, could turn up the sound a little bit?
Yeah, we'll go ahead and do that on our end if we can. I'm saying in the case where you've got a candidate who is running unopposed in Donald Trump, obviously he's going to win his own primary. Does that come into account when you are considering the results?
Well, Donald Trump's a sitting president. He's sitting presidents normally do quite well in the early primaries, but not all of them do. And if they don't, and if they falter, etc., that's usually a sign that they're not going to do well in the end. So, for example, Jimmy Carter in 1980, mm-hmm. George W. Bush 1992. Ford in 76, all, and some others who even didn't even continue after some poor showing early on, like way back in 68, for Lyndon Johnson. So anytime a sitting president doesn't care very well, that usually is a bad omen. And we know that sitting presidents typically do well in getting reelected, but the ability to win big in primaries is a very sort of good predictor, even for them. And that's why I have pretty good faith that this will work out this time as well.
Now, you had, in I think about a month and a half, 2 months ago, you said that you would guess 91% chance that the president gets reelected, and I think you called it a landslide. Do you mean Electoral College landslide and not popular vote, or does popular vote come up in your model?
Well, after the last election, when we had a situation where one candidate wins the popular vote and the other one wins the electoral vote, I decided that this time I would purely make a prediction about the electoral vote. Because in the end, it doesn't matter. It's a popular vote. Yeah. If somebody else wins the electoral vote. And we have a little bit of a sort of disjuncture that I don't think we know enough about why that is. And so I felt it was not a good idea to do as I had done before, to do something for the popular vote and then simply do a correlation between that and then the electoral vote. So I went straight to the electoral vote, and I really sort of calibrated my model for all the previous elections as well, and did it for the electoral vote. And so I don't have anything to say about the popular vote, whatever that may be, but I'm pretty sure that in the final analysis, the electoral vote will break for Trump.
Well, we obviously, on the Conservative Talk Station here, we hope that you're right. We've been talking with Helmut Norpoth. He is a professor at Stony Brook's Department of Political Science. Thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank Thank you very much for having me. Anytime. Thank you.
Good night. Absolutely. So that is going to come as some good news for folks who look at what's been going on in the polls. He's not, by the way, the only one who had this prediction. Robert Kahaly, who was, I think, the highest profile pollster back in 2016 to predict President Trump would win. He's from Trafalgar Polls. He has the same position now. He was on with a podcast called The Gist.
I think Trump wins in the mid-270s. I think he wins Florida. I don't think Florida's a question. Ohio and Florida are not a question. Anybody talking about Georgia and Texas, that ain't going to happen. I think North Carolina, he'll edge out North Carolina and win it. And then he'll win Arizona. And so then it comes down to he only has to win one of Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. And I believe he will win one of them. And I think Michigan is an excellent chance for Trump victory. I would say probably of those four, Michigan is the most likely one that he will win. And if he wins the others, that's all he needs.
There you go. I always, when I listen to this stuff, at least the stuff I can understand, because sometimes the phone connection isn't very good. I want to make sure that I'm not having my own bias seep into my expectations, and I'm hoping that this is going to repeat what happened in 2016, where everyone essentially said he is for sure going to lose. In fact, you have that New York Times prediction model. What I think it actually might have been 91%. It was in the 90s that the president or the then candidate Donald Trump, of course, would never, ever, ever win. There's no chance of that. And then all of a sudden, bam, a lot of tears on CNN that night. And nothing has changed enough for me to think that the pollsters are any better now at reaching Trump supporters than they were in 2016. Part of that is because, number one, there is, from conservatives, just a general distrust of the pollsters. On top of that, we're at a time where, like in 2016, people were shamed for supporting the president. And even if you're talking to a stranger on the line asking you questions and you're never going to run into this person again, you do still feel like you're going to be judged by them. And that fear of judgment can get the person to lie to the pollster about their actual position. But I'm going to go with Trafalgar Polls, mostly because I couldn't understand most of what Helmut was saying. Could you understand him?
I mean, the gist. I got, like...
Did you?
I was probably getting 80% of what he was putting down.
Yeah? Give me one sentence.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's
no,
the pollster
okay.
And the modeler.
No, that's okay. You heard me say he's a pollster and a model.
No, I read our show sheet.
Yeah.
Because I do pre-show prep.
Just not on the phone to make sure its connection is clear.
What, you roll the dice when you...
No. I mean, you could have been like, hey, sir, I can't hear you. Let me call you since I called you first. It was that part.
I called him.
Who's on the line next? State Senator Ron Muzzle.
I was about to get to
that. Is that going
to
be okay? Or
yes.
Is our connection going to be okay? Are you sure?
Oh, what do you want? Okay.
Why don't you double check it for me?
Okay, I'll give him a call.
Jason Rancho on AM 770 KTTH, streaming on the KTTH smartphone app. A lot is on the line with this upcoming election. Ballots are in hand, and those of you who live in Washington's 10th legislative district, you've got the choice to elect a Republican who's going to be with you on the issues, or you can go with a Seattle-style Democrat. Senator Ron Muzzle currently represents the 10th District. This is Oak Harbor, Whidbey Island, Laconia, Mount Vernon, a whole bunch more. And he joins me now. Senator, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jason. I'm pleased to be here.
Does your opponent have an ideological agenda that matches your district?
I think that she professes to have that. I don't believe that that is truly her agenda, and it certainly hasn't been the agenda that they have demonstrated in the campaign.
Well, take us through some examples of that, because as you know, when there's a Republican going up against a Democrat, particularly in areas like yours, the tendency is to say that they don't have the values in mind, ideologically speaking, but then sometimes there's no actual follow-up. So take us through some of the issues.
Well, the 10th is essentially a 36% Democrat, 36% Republican, and the remainder, which is almost a third, is independent. So we are a purple district. We have some pretty conservative values, and then we've got some pretty moderate values on things. And I think that I represent that. My opponent is a party girl. She is very attached to the Democratic Party and loves to have her picture taken with Jay Inslee and Bob Ferguson. I think that that demonstrates the direction she will go once she gets to Olympia.
And the reason why that's so important, particularly if she would end up voting along the lines of what Governor Jay Inslee wants, that almost assuredly means higher taxes.
Exactly. And honestly, she's never seen a tax, whether it was on the school district when she was on the board there or as a county commissioner. She's never seen a tax she didn't like. And so I'm certain that when it comes down to whether it's a capital gains income tax or whether it's a regular income tax, that her vote is going to be yes. I don't think there's a doubt in anybody's mind.
And that's truly what's on the line here when it comes to taxes. We know that Democrats have wanted in the state of Washington to increase not just taxes in a general sense, but introduce an income tax and a capital gains tax that I believe is at like 7.5%. And we know that we've got this budget shortfall that we're going to have to deal with. So legislatively, from your position, what do you do to address the budget shortfall without increasing taxes?
Well, I think first off, we've been very surprised. Actually, September's receipts were higher than a year ago, September. So our 2020 income was higher than our 2009 September income, 2019 September income. So actually, we've got 6 months into 21 that's in this biennium. We're actually starting to dig ourselves out of a hole. Now, it still looks like there's going to be about a $2 billion shortfall. But there are lots of ways that we can overcome that. Out of a $26 billion budget for the year 2020, $2 billion out of that, we can kick a can down the road. We can reassess some income. We can look forward to possibly continuing on the path of collecting more without having to raise taxes. And Jason, even if we do raise taxes, it takes a while to collect those taxes. They don't just magically appear the next day. It's got to be instituted on and on in order to be able to even see that. It's 6 months before we see that income at the very least.
Just joining us, we're talking with State Senator Ron Muzzle from the 10th Legislative District. The website, ronmuzzle.com, M-U-Z-Z-A-L-L. You know, you talk about how it's all about being local and principled, and you've grown up in this particular district, and I look at the district, and it's absolutely huge. How do you maintain attention all across the parts of Skagit County and all Island County and actually, you know, make it into cohesive representation?
Well, interestingly, I spent 15 years on a ag co-op board that was its, essentially, its area of doing business. So we had stores in Stanwood and Mount Vernon and Burlington and Oak Harbor and Freeland. The area, as we know it, well, it's been home for our family for 110 years, but it's distinct. It's northwestern Snohomish County and then southwestern Skagit County and all of Island County. But it's home, and I've got friends and relatives that live throughout the district. I don't think I have any problem talking the language of the district.
Yeah.
It is, it's diverse, but there are certainly pockets that are, that aren't as diverse as far as political leanings in the district. But I think the most important thing is the willingness to have dialogue on any subject. And I've always been willing to do that, in a time when that isn't always necessarily the case.
One issue that is particularly unique to your district is ferry service and how incredibly important it is because you represent all of Island County. There was this threat, I want to say maybe a month ago or maybe even less than that, where you would eliminate some ferry service on the Port Townsend Coopville route. What's being done to help sort of keep service, not just in that area, but in upkeeping of the ferry system in general?
Well, the governor told all of the departments to look at, I think it was a 15% cut.
Yeah.
And I hate to say it, but I think some of the departments just looked for something that they could cut easily that was going to amount to 15%. Because we saw other departments that said, oh, we're going to cut this. And then we went back to them and said, hey, you can't do that. Well, we aren't really going to do that, but it was just, you know, a number that we could throw together. My guess is that if you look at the number that Port Townsend Coopville run, as they call it now, I've been there too long. I still think it was Keystone. But that run probably was amounted to 15% of the ferry budget. And so it was easy to say, oh, we're just going to cut that. That, though it's the smallest ferries in the line, it is a lifeline for the peninsula mainland run. And so it really drew a lot of attention, which also may have been part of the reasoning to use it as an example of something to cut, because it was going to create a big wave. Pardon the pun, we're talking about ferries.
Last question for you. 976 and this ruling by the state Supreme Court to overturn the will of the people on $30 car tap fees. What can be done legislatively with the Democrats? Because it seems like the Democrats, at least from Seattle, were the reason why we had this challenge to begin with.
So I wasn't a huge fan of $30. If it had been $100 car tabs, I think it would have been a little more realistic. And, you know, a lot of this came from Sound Transit Rebellion and the fact that Sound Transit's had these issues with being over time and over budget, not just a little bit, but significantly. So probably the reality is that State Supreme Court, this ruling was truly a good ruling. It probably the title and the substance of the initiative was off base. As far as what the legislature's going to do, I don't think that we'll get a few moderate Democrats to swing that way, and I think the Republicans will all support it. Steve O'Bann's got is already working on a bill, but I don't think we'll get enough Democrats to come to our side to legislatively do anything about it.
And that, of course, is a problem that gets way worse if Helen Price Johnson, who's your opponent, actually wins this thing. So make sure if you're in the 10th Legislative District, you're going with State Senator Ron Muzzle. Again, the website, RONMUZZALL.com. Senator, thank you so much for stopping by. I appreciate it.
And thank you, Jason. Take care now.
Absolutely. You as well. You've been listening to The Jason Rancho. Thank you so much for tuning in. I really do appreciate it. Coming up next, Ben Shapiro.